We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Focus. Good morning. I'm Bill Hammack. Today I'm looking at technologies that can be used to change how we use and produce energy. We'll examine well-known alternatives like solar and wind, but also spend time on more obscure technologies like biochar. My guest today wrote the book 10 Technologies to Save the Planet, Energy Options for a Low-Carbon Future. It's a fascinating book that doesn't pretend that the road ahead is easy, but instead lays out alternative energy solutions in their full complexity. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area or anywhere else in North America. Call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Or send me a question via email at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Let's welcome to Focus Chris Goodall.
Hello.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
We'll discuss thoroughly in the next hour all 10 technologies, but let's start with why you wrote the book and the tone of the book. You open by saying, and I quote here, "The book is more restrained," end quote, and you were reacting to what you'd heard from stockbrokers and entrepreneurs. What were you hearing that called for restraint?
Well, if you believe in a technology, you do have a tendency, don't you, to think that it's more important, more relevant, easier to do than everything else. And there was a tendency, there still is a tendency, for people who are backing new energy techniques to say that everything's going to be easy. And my purpose in writing the book is to say it's not going to be easy, but we do have the wherewithal, we do have the means to actually completely decarbonize, to use that awful phrase, that's to say stop burning fossil fuels across industry and domestic usage.
So you were, though, in a position where you were hearing from stockbrokers and entrepreneurs and people were pitching. Is that right?
Yes. I still do. I mean, my mailbox is full every day with people saying that they have the solution.
And why do they send these to you? What is it that you do?
Well, I write books and journalism for the British newspaper, The Guardian. Mm-hmm. I have a blog on which I talk about some of the newest technologies, the most interesting technologies, the ones which look as though they might have the prospect of giving us an extra 5 or 10% of our energy from low-carbon sources.
So throughout the book, you try to steer a line between the technophiles, I'll call them, who believe free markets will naturally bring about the growth of alternatives to oil, coal, and gas, and the environmental pessimists who think the world is hurling toward catastrophe at increasing speed. So explain why you think there's a middle line that you use in this book that's fruitful. Won't the market response...
Talk about the pessimists for a second. The eco-pessimists, the people who say, look, it's all over for humanity. We've made a mess of the planet. Biodiversity is collapsing. We're running out of fuel. Mm-hmm. We have destroyed our ability to use this wonderfully productive planet for the 6 or 7 billion people who now live there. And we must therefore withdraw. We must, as it were, move into tents and start living with zero impact on the world around us, mm-hmm. create our, and gather and hunt and gather our food as we might have done 5,000 years ago. Now, I can see why they say that. I mean, it might be 1 or 2% of the population in places like Britain and North America. It's not a huge number of people, and most people do not want their future to be like that. They want the material comforts, which we've got used to over the last century, and they have no intention of voluntarily going back to even 20 years ago in terms of what they have in material comfort. So we're not going to generate massive social change, which reduces our energy consumption. At the other extreme, those people who say that merely by using science and technology we can get out of all the problems we have, environmental problems we have around the world, I think are also wrong. Mm-hmm. Some changes in the way we view ourselves and the planet need to be introduced. We've got to start seeing our resources as not infinite. We have a major threat from climate change. I think it's increasingly apparent that the patterns of weather around the world are changing and possibly changing dramatically. And we are certainly overusing our resources, limited resources of fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. So somewhere in the middle is a route
approach I would like to take, which is to say we can't give up too much. We can't expect people to change their lifestyles enormously. We do, however, have to change things slightly, and we have to be much more sensible in how we use energy. And we can find low-carbon substitutes for coal, gas, natural gas, and oil. And we should continue to do so, but it's not going to be easy.
So in the book, you look at 10 specific and separate ways to significantly reduce emissions or extract large volumes of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, suggesting that once we switch from coal, gas, and oil, we'll find energy costs no higher than they are today and maybe lower. So let's look at those 10 technologies that I think for each you were looking at a 10% reduction in CO2. So let's start with some of the biggies. Let's start with wind. First, wind. What's the current stage and what's the future for wind?
Well, in some countries, and the U.S. is rapidly moving into this selection, in some countries, wind is already performing a very useful function as a percentage of total electricity supply. And it's coming down in price and will continue to come down in price.
Mm-hmm.
And most people say that large wind farms composed of hundreds of similar turbines over large stretches of countryside where there is a good connection to the national energy infrastructure, what in Britain we call the grid,
mm-hmm.
Is now a perfectly effective substitute for coal-fired power stations. It probably isn't. In some countries, it's already cheaper. It's not probably cheaper in the United States,
mm-hmm.
except perhaps in parts of Texas.
Right. So let's go over the reasons though that it's cheaper. I think the key there was when you said infrastructure, right? What infrastructure is it that is not in the U.S. in Britain?
It depends where you are. I mean, mm-hmm. critically, the economics of wind critically depend in many countries on the availability of a large network of high voltage lines able to transmit the energy generated in the wind turbines to the major population centres where that electricity is needed.
So
generally, wind is strongest mm-hmm. well away from population centres.
So we tend to build cities over, you know, hundreds, thousands of years in places where it wasn't windy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the issue now is getting the power from those windy areas to the cities. Is that
In some places, mm-hmm. for example, as in the north of Britain, the country called Scotland has fantastic mm-hmm. resources of wind. It has a very poor connection to the major the places where the electricity is mainly needed in Britain, which is the southern half
mm-hmm.
of our small island.
So
that's the same problem in most places. Not mm-hmm. not everywhere, mm-hmm. but most mm-hmm. places there is a problem of getting enough capacity to transmit the electricity.
So give me a feeling, though. I mean, at first blush, a power line, what a simple thing to build. Is this expensive? Is this complicated?
Frankly, it's not expensive in terms of the total cost of the infrastructure that we need to decarbonize our electricity.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the British energy regulator today said we need to spend about £32 billion, that's about $50 billion, on energy infrastructure, power lines and the other things, and we need to spend approximately $300 billion on actually decarbonizing electricity. That is to say, closing down the coal and gas-fired power stations and replacing them with other sources. So
mm-hmm.
infrastructure is not a huge percentage of the total cost. However, it's in most countries, the energy markets do not allow that infrastructure cost to be paid for. There is no economic incentive for anybody to build the extensions to the grid in many places.
So is what
failure of a market.
So what is what you mean by that is that the it's a failure of regulation, is it not?
Highly regulated markets are a failure of regulation. The UK is a pretty free electricity market.
So what you mean is if in the US, perhaps, a power company wanted to build power lines, they couldn't charge that rate or that's a surcharge back to their users for that?
Yeah, particularly if the electricity is shipped across state lines.
Mm-hmm.
That's my understanding. I'm not an expert on US energy policy.
Fair enough.
That seems to be, reading between the lines, that seems to be one of the key issues.
Right. So, Chris,
wind in the mm-hmm. Midwest. There's plenty of wind in Texas. It's not always possible to get the state utility commissions to allow the producers the cost inflation necessary to take that to, say, California, where energy is short.
Mm-hmm. So, Chris, we have a caller. We have a caller on line 4 from Belgium. So, caller, please go ahead.
Yes. I don't think you've broached this subject yet. I'd like to hear your aspects on it. why hasn't the world, now I know Japan and Germany are moving in this direction, but why haven't we moved more towards hydrogen? There's a fabulous fuel, a technology that would be sellable all over the world, so it'd make a lot of money for whoever produces it. Why don't we move in that direction? It's cleaner fuel.
This is a fascinating question, and I believe, if I'm correct, Chris, it is not one of your 10 technologies.
No, it isn't.
So what?
I look at it briefly when I talk about the electrification of transport.
Okay.
And I think if I could take some of the lessons from that chapter for your caller now,
sure,
that
yes,
might be appropriate.
Of course.
I think that hydrogen is going to be an important fuel of the future. But remember, most of the time today, when we're creating hydrogen, we're doing so by breaking water. We're splitting water into hydrogen atoms and oxygen atoms. That takes a lot of energy to do. In order to get hydrogen, which does not exist in the atmosphere as a single atom or molecule, in order to get it, we have to use electricity to break down water or to gasify complex hydrocarbons. Mostly, it's breaking down water. And the energy you use to break down water into hydrogen and oxygen is generally considerably greater than the energy value of burning the hydrogen, then burning the hydrogen. So there's no net energy saving from doing this. However, your caller, of course, is absolutely right. Hydrogen is clean. It burns to water and nothing else. And if we can find a way of generating hydrogen without expensive use of energy, then it will form a major part of the energy mix in the future.
So
can I interject?
Sure, go ahead, caller.
Sir, isn't Coke, when you produce Coke to use in the steel industry, you generate a lot of hydrogen that is just turned around and burned off just to use as heat. Why can't we just save this? And there's many techniques like that that generate hydrogen that we can utilize in producing this situation.
So the caller has a fascinating question there. Is there a cogeneration that would provide hydrogen?
Yes. I mean, one of the technologies, frankly, I think is most interesting is gasifying hydrocarbons under the ground, coal gasification. That will produce hydrogen as one of the products of that. And then that hydrogen can be used for generating electricity, probably in fuel cells and things which directly turn hydrogen which create power through the conversion of hydrogen into water without burning. I think there are huge opportunities to use the gas byproducts of the heating of hydrocarbons, such as the one your caller mentioned, the gasification of coke for use in the steel industry. But there aren't the volumes available of hydrogen to do that at the moment. We still have the problem of storage, and we have to make sure that if we burn the carbon at the same time in the hydrocarbon, then we capture the carbon dioxide, and we'll talk about this as one of the other technologies, and store it underground. So there's a complex matrix of problems here, but your caller is absolutely right. There are opportunities here for significant energy and carbon saving.
Okay. Let's turn to a caller then on line one from Vermilion County. So line one caller, please go ahead.
Good morning. I'd like to go back to wind.
Yes.
It seems to me here in central Illinois, we have some possibilities of wind farms going up, and some of them already have. And the whole economic balance of who trades what kind of credits for what may possibly be a lot of what happens as to why different things are done in different regions. I know that aesthetics and conservation and other things are also factors. For example, in the New England area, there was a big fuss about windmills off the coast of Massachusetts or someplace.
A bay there, yes.
And here in the Midwest, it seems to me that an important factor is the fact that this is prime agricultural land. There was a BBC program about the value of land and how land globally is, you know, something that needs to be considered. And when we talk about wind farms in places where there's not much happening in terms of food production, or whether I'm thinking of Wyoming or someplace where there's a lot of space, or off the coast. It seems to me that the bigger picture should also include, or must include, long-term, the production of different parts of the earth, so that we're not basically making more parking lots or more taking away food production areas. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much that has been addressed by people in your field about that, but I think that's an important long-term consideration.
The caller brings up an interesting way to think about this, which is the lost opportunity cost as you use land to do something else. Can you address that for wind? Is that a large issue?
In the case of wind, the loss to agriculture is pretty small. Mm-hmm. We're talking only 1 or 2%, if I remember correctly, of the total land out here, Larry. You can still use it for agriculture underneath. And I own shares in a couple of small wind farms, and I can tell you walking around them that those remain used for agricultural land as well. It's actually quite low-value agricultural land, mostly because windy sites are not generally very good for growing things on, mm-hmm. for obvious reasons. But the more important question, or absolutely vital question your caller raises, is how are we going to manage to generate enough food for 10 billion people in 40 years' time, or possibly more, and also use the land for energy source? Because one of the chapters in the book is about the use of land for what's called biomass, primarily trees and other crops that we can use for burning or for turning into liquid fuel. Mm-hmm. And there, I think, there is a major problem. The world is running out of arable land, and if we continue to grow in prosperity around the world, we will eat more meat, and meat requires many-fold times more land than growing the same amount of calories in grain. So as the world gets more prosperous and it gets higher income, we're going to run into greater and greater problems of the shortage of usable land. The other thing, and I have to mention this because it is, I think, increasingly an obvious issue, is that as climate change takes hold, the percentage of the world's surface that can be used productively for agriculture is almost certainly going down significantly. Mm-hmm. We saw over the summer, for example, in the Pakistan floods, the desolation of a large part of some of the most productive agricultural land in Asia along the Indus Valley. That sort of thing is going to occur more and more as the climate becomes more unreliable and more extreme. So your caller is absolutely right. We have to worry about the amount of land that we give over to energy production. Wind, however, is pretty good in the sense that you can continue to do productive agriculture at the same time as having the wind generation.
Okay, this is Bill Hammack, and I'm visiting with author Chris Goodall. We're discussing energy options for our future by looking at real-world technologies like wind and solar, and we'll get to some that are a little bit less well-known. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area. Anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Or use email, WILL-talk. At illinois.edu. So our last caller also, I think, highlighted an interesting observation that she talked about, you know, how things are in the Midwest, and that leads us to, are we going to look at sort of patchwork local solutions and no longer a global solution like we have with fossil fuels? Is that where we're going?
It's very tempting, isn't it, to think that the way to solve this problem of declining resources of fossil fuels and worries about climate change is to try to do everything at the most local possible level.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, you've got a farm, you need energy for that farm, so you put up a wind turbine. Now, that might seem a good idea, but it doesn't actually solve the problem as well as huge installations involving power station-scale operations. They'll be cheaper, they'll be more efficient, and they will be easier to manage from the perspective of those people who have to control the electricity grid. Mm-hmm. So although those people who are worried about these issues want to put in small-scale power, decentralized power, it is often a very inefficient way of doing it. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to get control of this problem, we have to move to not just small installations of local power, but massive installations of power, of sources of power, equivalent to large power stations. I mean, it takes something like 5,000 large wind turbines to to replace the output of a single large coal-fired power station. Mm-hmm. So that's an illustration of the scale of the challenge of moving away from these fossil fuel power stations.
In fact, a subtext to your book is really, it's not explicit in there, but a subtext is there's a fantasy that we'll live in this self-contained farm, essentially, but that we need to look at solutions that are larger. And that
I know,
actually...
and it's very uncomfortable for environmentalists mm-hmm. who think it's just replacing one nasty technology, fossil fuels, coal-fired power stations spitting out all sorts of pollution and mm-hmm. carbon dioxide, mm-hmm. With a new one, thousands of wind turbines, for example. And many of Europe's leading environmentalists are appalled by this prospect.
Mm-hmm.
I try to say in the book that, frankly, ladies and gentlemen, there isn't really an alternative, because you are not going to persuade the vast majority of ordinary people around the world to give up the ready availability of electricity and liquid fuels mm-hmm. to move themselves around in cars.
So let's take a look at a second technology as we kind of work our way through the 10, solar technology. Again, what's the current stage and what's the future for that?
Well, for the last 50 or 60 years, since solar photovoltaic technology has been commercialized, everybody's been assuming that in the next 5 years there'll be major reductions in cost.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, it's been a bit slow. Many of the technologies which we think, many of the new advances in photovoltaic that we hoped were going to revolutionize the cost and performance of solar photovoltaic cells have not proved anywhere near as good as we expected. So there's change happening, and in some parts of the world with very high levels of sun and high energy costs, such as small island states, such as the Maldives in the Indian Ocean, which I've worked with, solar is pretty competitive and can deliver reliable energy and electricity at prices equivalent to their very expensive prices from creating energy, electricity from mm-hmm. diesel fuel at the moment.
So,
in other places, it's not yet competitive, and the progress, is sometimes disappointingly slow.
So let's look at that technology a little bit. The issue is we have silicon photovoltaic cells, and it's their efficiency, right? And there was a hope that we could make cells of different materials, I think it's gallium arsenide or something,
yeah.
that are more efficient. Is that the technology that just has not quite worked out yet?
We're hoping that it's going to be more efficient, but frankly, the people spending the billions of dollars of venture capital money, particularly in the United States, on these technologies are hoping that the cost of making them is going to fall.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're working on.
So
at the moment, a big slab of silicon, a very, very pure silicon, is an extremely expensive piece of kit. There's no denying that fact. It costs mm-hmm. hundreds of dollars to thousands of dollars to generate a kilowatt, and progress, as I say, has not been as fast as people hoped.
But the key problem is making these alternate ones cheaply. Is that not it? I mean, the technology is proven in some laboratory sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there are cases of in specialized laboratories. Of the efficiency rising to 40 or 50% of the energy hitting the solar panel from the sun. But the majority of solar panels installed on people's houses only generate a third of the electricity of that, and that hasn't changed much in 20 years.
So we have a couple more callers. I want to go to line one in Seymour. So, Seymour, please go ahead. Is our caller there in Seymour? Nope. We have a caller on line four from Effingham, so please go ahead. I'm sorry, we have some kind of technological issue. So if those callers will call back, I'd appreciate that. Let's look at some more technologies that perhaps people haven't heard of as much. Let's look at super efficient homes. You use the word, I believe, Passivhaus?
Passive house.
Passive house.
It's a German expression mm-hmm. which is coming into use around the world. I think people understand. Mm-hmm. Pretty much everywhere, what it's likely to mean.
So what does this mean? Define one for me.
It means a house sufficiently well insulated, even in a cold country, that you don't need any form of central heating.
Mm-hmm.
That you use for your heating the energy coming from the sun. You use solar energy even in winter, and you use the energy that you get from running the appliances in your home, and indeed from just walking around. I mean, when you're walking around your house, you're giving off about 100 watts of heat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's enough, in combination with other things, to keep your house very warm. But it depends on the house being extremely well insulated, extremely airtight, and being made with modern construction that will mean that you pretty much don't have to spend anything at all on utility bills, on heating bills.
So there's 10 or 20 thousands of these houses in existence, and there's actually a code. Is that not right? In
Europe? Yeah, there's a
there's a series of standards, and there are small numbers of houses being built in the United States to this standard, but it's developed by people in Germany, a bunch of engineers in Germany, who said, we can make really significant differences to the energy efficiency of housing. Even in cold countries, housing loses 10 times as much energy through the walls and windows as it needs to do. We've never devoted the attention to this, and it's only the fact that energy is becoming very expensive, and heating oils, gas, natural gas becoming expensive, that's forced people into considering how to make houses much more efficient. And the scope, particularly in very badly insulated housing, such as we've got in Britain, is utterly enormous. And buildings are responsible for between, depending on the part of the world you're in, between a quarter and a half of all energy consumption. So the scope here for making significant changes in our total energy use is really significant.
And is the sense here to retrofit existing houses, or is this the new construction?
Well, what I try to show in the book is that although most of the attention has gone on exciting new houses, glamorous eco houses, actually the big gain is going to be from using these techniques on existing houses. In most countries, it's only about 1% or less of the total housing stock is created new each year. That means 99 remain inefficient and badly insulated. So what we've got to try to do, as I say in the book, is find the techniques that enable us to take these advances in the new housing and put them onto old housing. And I give some examples of single-family homes, blocks of apartments around the world where this has been done successfully, trying to show that actually it's relatively inexpensive to make significant changes to the insulation standards of the house.
And Chris, we have a caller. So caller from line one in Champaign, please go ahead.
Yes, does that be me?
Yes, that's you. Go ahead, please.
Well, my question is, I agree with all the energy savings type stuff that we need to be doing and all that, but it seems to me like isn't energy population control like the elephant in the room? Isn't that the logical thing that we should be looking at, trying to keep the population down a little bit or something? I don't understand. Is there some sort of huge objection to just trying to keep our population from exploding so much? I'll just listen off.
All right, thank you. Chris.
Well, the toughest issue, isn't it? We're going to see probably a 50% increase in population.
Right.
And those people in the next 50 years before it peaks around 2050. And those people are going to want the same sort of standard of living that we folk in rich countries have today. We've got every reason to want that. My conclusion is, yes, it's worth thinking about population control. It's very important. But in countries which have become prosperous over the past 100 years, we've seen almost miraculously a reduction in female fertility at the same time. That is to say, once women become better, become educated, become able to control their own destiny, prosperity of the country is increased. Women, husbands, wives do not want as many children as they wanted in the past. There is a natural tendency for population to start falling. I mean, across most of Europe now, the population would be falling were it not for immigration. And I suspect in other countries that position will move forward as well. As people come to feel that it's no longer necessary to have lots of children. So I think population is a huge issue, and it's a point that's raised every single time I give a talk or speak on the radio or whatever. On the other hand, the most effective form of population control is giving people authority over their own destiny. That means democracy and female education, not just telling people to reproduce less.
And we have a caller on line four from Effingham. So, Effingham, please go ahead.
Yes, the other caller preempted one of my subjects, but population and the sustainability of the numbers. Occurs to me that I think your guest, and I'd heard before, 12 billion is supportable. I don't think we are now supporting the 6 to 7 billion that are on Earth now, let alone double that. And then the capitalist paradigm of consumption, which is not working very well now and has not ever worked very well across the history, its history. And I guess my question is, in the arcane thinking that we can somehow keep reproducing and then have everything we want, have that as an image, which, you know, is a blatant lie, when 90% of people on this earth can't find enough to eat. And how are we going to continue that? And the last thing I want to say is the female, you know, that I call the opposite sex femme now, because they're in, what part of that is male, and the focus on them, when in reality it should be the vasectomizing of men.
All right, caller, thank you very much. Let's go ahead and be a little bit regional here. I'm sitting here in central Illinois in the midst of farmland, and can you explain to me why or why not ethanol is the biofuel of the future?
Yes, of course. I mean, you're right at the center of this. I mean, what I do say in the book, and I've said in journalism extensively, I hope, is that first-generation ethanol, that is to say, taking the sugars from corn and turning them in through a process of fermentation into ethanol, which is alcohol to most of us, and then burning it in cars, was never likely to be a good way of replacing fossil fuels. Making corn and other crops which can be turned quickly into ethanol is in itself an energy-intensive process. You won't get any energy saving. You have to fertilize the fields, you have to drive your tractors over them, you then have to take the product to a distillery, and you have to use heat to turn the sugars in the corn into ethanol. Very energy-intensive, no net saving, and it increases the price of corn because more corn is used for that and less is made available for food.
Mm-hmm.
So first-generation biofuels have been rightly written off, and we should start closing the places where we make them. However, that doesn't mean to say that all vegetable sources, plant sources of fuel need to be disregarded. Henry Ford, right at the beginning of the automation of car manufacture, I think in the 1920s, talked to someone and pointed at a tree and said, there's enough energy in that tree to keep that car going for a year.
Mm-hmm.
If we use trees, other forms of fast-growing biomass, the things that grow on the Earth's surface, and turn the whole tree, the cellulose, the lignin, everything else, into fuels, then and we use waste and rapidly regrowing plantations, we can find sources of liquid fuel that can replace gasoline as the way in which we fuel our cars. But there need to be substantial advances in technology there, because the molecules in trees, grasses, particularly cellulose and lignin, are very difficult to break down. I mean, we have to use enzymes to do that, and we have to use a lot of heat at the moment, once again raising the question as to whether there's any net energy savings.
So you're talking about cellulose here, and the scale is enormous. Some 200 million acres, I think, would be needed to do this. It's larger than all the farmland devoted to crops today, about the same space as by the U.S. National Forest or the whole of Texas. And that's to produce 160 billion gallons of gasoline. Is this possible then?
No, I think it needs to be combined with other technologies. For a start, we need to significantly improve the efficiency of the internal combustion engine. We haven't made much progress there over the last 100 years. It's still only turning about a quarter of the energy in our fuels into motion. And we need to electrify cars and automobiles. That is to say, we need to start using batteries. For some forms of transport, particularly long-distance heavy vehicles, we'll need to use liquid fuels or possibly hydrogen, to go back to the first question we took. But what I try to say in the book is that we're going to solve the needs for transport,
by a mixture of improved efficiency in internal combustion engines, by the use of cellulose-based fuels, liquid fuels, and by the conversion of most cars to battery-powered electricity.
Well, let's return to cars in a minute. This is Focus, and I'm Bill Hammack. I'm talking with Chris Goodall, author of 10 Technologies to Save the Planet, Energy Options for a Low-Carbon Future. It's a fascinating book that doesn't pretend that the road ahead is easy, but instead lays out alternative energy solutions in their full complexity. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL. If you're in the area, anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455, or use email, will-talk@illinois.edu. So just a moment ago, we were talking, Chris, about electric cars. What are the key problems for electric cars?
Well, I'm sure you're seeing them in the United States as we are over here. Electric cars are expensive because batteries are expensive. Like the kind of huge batteries which we need in order to drive a car are still costly to produce. Then the second issue is the range of the car. How far will it go before you need to recharge it? And the third issue is how long it takes to recharge the car. It's no good if it takes overnight. You're stuck 100 miles from your home as you need to plug it in to charge it. Big progress, really substantial progress occurring on all those three things. In fact, faster than I expected when I wrote the book. I really think that within a few years, electric cars are going to become almost the conventional purchase for most people in cities who don't have huge distances to drive. So we're going to see the price falling as battery technology gets better. We're going to see the range increasing. And already, since I wrote the book, we're seeing very substantial reductions in the time taken to charge the car as we move from, say, 6 hours to charge it to down to a half an hour. That's roughly what's going to be the case in the UK, the next generation of charging points that are going to be installed. Some countries have gone for this in a really big way. Small island countries, places like Singapore, Israel, have made a real commitment to electric cars, and I think that's very sensible, and it will help those countries develop knowledge and expertise that can be used around the world.
Let's turn to another caller, a caller on line one in Urbana. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to ask about energy storage. It seems to me that's one of the biggest problems, and about the flywheel and the capacitor. What are the the odds of them being important in the next decade?
So is this key for wind energy? Is that how we're thinking of it?
The problem with many sources of alternative energy, such as wind, is that you can't guarantee that it will be available to you tomorrow in the quantity you need at 12:43 a.m. We cannot predict wind. We cannot predict some other technologies such as solar. But we can buttress them with some of the other technologies I talk in the book so that they're ready when the wind is not. But it's an absolute prerequisite for us to improve energy storage, to find some sort of industrial-scale energy storage. There are a number of technologies I talk briefly about in the book which are jostling. Big flywheels, what your caller mentioned, they have a huge weight turning with enough momentum that it has a respectable amount of stored energy. Compressing air and then stuffing it into, say, abandoned salt caverns beneath the surface, that's also, it's quite energy intense to do that. We, in hilly countries, we can pump water up to high reservoirs, and then when we need the electricity, we can let it go through turbines to regenerate that electricity. There are a number of these competing for tensions, capacitors, as mentioned also by your caller. All of them possess some interesting characteristics. None of them are yet competitive, and that's one of the major areas I know of investment in venture capital companies in the United States. But we do need to understand that without forms of mass storage for electricity primarily, we're not going to be able to make the switch.
So it's probably useful to point out to our callers that our current grid, which is largely fossil fuel run, has no storage capability. That's the way it was designed, or very minimal storage
capability.
Well, it
has very minimal. In the case of the British grid, for example, we have the capacity, if one large power station stopped working, we generally have the capacity in terms of stored water to replace that power station for about 6 hours. And that's not atypical. In other words, we have got to improve our storage probably by two or three orders of magnitude if we're going to deal with the issues of intermittency or unreliability.
So let's talk about producing energy a bit. You you mentioned in there capturing carbon or carbon sequestration. Can you tell us what the latest is and what the promise is in this area?
Yeah, first of all, if I may, I'd say whenever I'm asked about these 10 technologies, which is the most important, I say this one is, because the world's power today is generated by a mixture of coal. Electricity is mixed by a mixture of coal and other highly carbon-intensive fuels. And if we don't find a way of continuing to use those power stations, but extracting the carbon, we're going to be in a real mess because we continue to construct coal-fired power stations today, particularly in places like China. What we need to do is to take there are several different ways of capturing the carbon dioxide from the process of generating electricity. We can either try and split the hydrocarbon we use before we burn it and separate off the carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide that comes from the process, possibly using then having some nice hydrogen, which we can then use for other purposes, which I think your second caller talked about. Or, more likely, we burn the fossil fuel, such as the coal, and we generate principally carbon dioxide, and we then separate off that carbon dioxide from the nitrogen, the air of nitrogen that remains in the flue gas, and we put it underneath us in some form of long-term geologic storage. And around the world, there are 5-10 places where there's really substantial experiments on this. My point in the book is we need to up this. We need to spend billions. As a global society, we need to spend many billions of pounds making sure this happens and happens quickly. There's interesting things going on, but it's not happening fast.
So this is one of the core issues in your book where you're really in the middle. If you ask a committed environmentalist about carbon sequestration, you're going to hear some squawking. Why is that?
Because they say that what I and other people are suggesting is merely continuing with the bad habits of the past and trying to gloss over their impact by continuing to burn coal and then just stuffing it underground. It's merely delaying the problem, the solution to the problem, rather than dealing with the root cause. And some very considerable sympathy, I think we all have very considerable sympathy about that view, but I think it's fundamentally wrong. I think we've got to accept the fact that of the power station capacity installed today, something like 60% is powered by coal worldwide. That number is probably not going to go down in the next 20 years. We're continuing to see massive investment in coal-fired power stations. We therefore have to find a way of sequestering the carbon that comes out of it. And it's unfortunate, it's unpleasant. There are lots of problems involved in carbon capture and storage, but we don't, in my opinion, have any alternative.
So let's look at that sequestration in a little bit of a different way. One of your technologies, number 9, I believe, in the book, was one that wasn't familiar to me. It's called biochar, I believe. What is that?
What I try to say in the book is it's probably not enough for the world just to stop adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. We need to find ways of extracting carbon dioxide from the atmosphere today. And I think the most interesting, one of the two or three most interesting ways of doing this is, as you say, biochar. Biochar is another word for charcoal made from agricultural waste and from trees and grasses. The idea is this, that when a living plant grows, it grows by the process of extracting carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And that carbon dioxide, broken and created into organic molecules, creates the structure of the tree or the grass or the plant. When that tree dies normally, falls on the floor and dies and rots, that carbon dioxide is returned to the atmosphere. There's no net gain or loss of carbon dioxide in the process of the tree's growth and death. If, however, we said that large fractions of the world where trees are grown or agricultural waste are created in large volume, we didn't let the tree die and rot. We heated that tree in the absence of air. That will drive off the volatile molecules and just create carbon, a charcoal in effect. We all know what charcoal is. That charcoal is incredibly chemically stable. If we dig it into the ground, it stays there for hundreds of years. And in so doing, we have in effect stored the carbon that the tree had taken from the atmosphere, resulting in a net diminution of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now, if we do that on a large enough scale, we can disrupt the global carbon cycle to an extent that we take significant amounts of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And various people like James Lovelock, the climate scientist, Jim Hansen, have said that this is a significant way of getting large amounts of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. It sounds as though it's small scale, but if we do it on a big scale around the world, we can make a really substantial difference to the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere over a period of a generation. And the second thing is biochar adds to soil fertility, particularly in carbon-poor soils. If we add charcoal, ground-up charcoal, we find that the amount of agricultural production we get from that land increases. So it has the benefit also of potentially increasing agricultural yield, particularly in areas where soil has been degraded. Much of the tropics is in that category.
That's a fascinating one. I'd not heard of that before. Let's look at other ones that maybe people wouldn't expect to be in there. Energy from the oceans. Tell us a little bit about this.
Not relevant to where you are.
Fair enough, but...
Around some places in the world, a large fraction of the coastlines have some form of very large-scale energy available for to use, whether it be the waves or the tides or the currents, the major ocean currents around the world. Britain is a fantastic place for this. Around the coast of Britain, there are some of the fastest-running tides in the world. And a tide, of course, is composed of water, and water is 1,000 times denser than air. So what we need to find is ways of using wind turbine technology and putting it into tidal streams where we can generate much more energy and where we can generate it with utter reliability. We know when a tide is going to come to the minute 100 years in advance. So it can supplement other less reliable sources of wind, of renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
Waves, similarly. There are lots of west-facing coasts around the globe, places as diverse as Chile or South Africa or parts of Asia. There are strong waves where it would be perfectly possible to generate large amounts of energy. The problem is that wave power is not. We can't predict how much it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And there are times when the amount of energy is so massive, so enormous, that it's impossible to design something to withstand the energy in that wave. And therefore, it's a very huge engineering challenge to build wave generation collecting devices that will prove resilient in some of the most difficult seas of the world. But the opportunities are there, ranging from also things like using the Gulf Stream, the hot water, the warm water that runs past Florida and across the Atlantic and ends up warming Britain in the winter. That also is a current which can be utterly relied upon and can be used, although it's much lower speed than the kinds of tides I've been talking about, can be used to generate energy reliably.
So for those listeners who are counting, we've gotten to 8 of the 10 technologies. And instead of do the last two, I want to spend just a little bit of time on what's not in the book, because I think that's almost equally interesting. A glaring example is nuclear energy. Why didn't you include that?
Well, I've had something of a conversion since writing the book, and I've gone to a lot of trouble by saying that actually it seems to me that the ecological arguments against nuclear energy are not particularly strong. People sometimes faint when I say that. But it doesn't seem to me, as someone looking at this technology, that the ecological arguments are sufficiently strong to rule nuclear energy out. The problem with nuclear energy, and I do say this in the book, is that it does appear to be extremely costly, and the cost isn't going down. So although the world is beginning to build a new generation of nuclear power stations, there are 25 nuclear power stations under construction in China at the moment, for example, it's not completely clear that these power stations will be cost competitive with either fossil fuels or the other technologies that I talk about in the book. However, it does seem to me in places like Britain where there's a reluctance to make any choice about what technology to go with, there are people willing to build nuclear power stations in this country, and I say let them go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it's their money and they're risking their financial returns, I think that nuclear power should be allowed, and I probably should have said that in the book.
So, Chris, there's a tone of caution throughout the book. It's not a pie in the sky, isn't clean tech so perfect kind of read. You temper the good with the bad, but keep a sense of hope for the future. We have about a minute left here. How would you rate our chances?
Do you want my honest answer?
Sure.
Not very high.
Really?
I don't think we've begun to understand the scale of the challenge yet. And my sense is that climate change is happening. The destructive effects of climate change are happening far faster than we imagined that they would. And I don't see that any political will around the world, except in a few places, certainly not Britain, probably not the United States, to make the huge investments that are needed to move us away from the use of fossil fuels.
Well, Chris, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Chris Goodall, author of 10 Technologies to Save the Planet, Energy Options for a Low-Carbon Future. We got to 8 of those 10 technologies, and you might want to take a look at the book to find the other 2. The technical director for this segment was Jason Croft, and the producer was Harriet Williamson.